Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us to start another week. It is Monday, March 25th. You're listening to the Mo News Podcast. I'm Mo Shwanunu.
And I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts.
And we read all the news and read between the lines so you don't have to. Jill, over the weekend, we posted on the Instagram account some profound conversation between Paul Simon and Stephen Colbert. It's actually, I think the full interview is a half an hour if you find it online. But there's a clip of Paul Simon talking about whether he believes the world was created by God or there's another explanation. And that either explanation, regardless of the explanation, it doesn't make him any less grateful for the universe. So some profound thoughts to start the week with you.
Mosh, unexpectedly profound and deep on the Mo News premium account. I was telling you before we started the podcast that I just love the premium feed. I've been loving the weekends, especially because I feel like it's this great mix of news and analysis and Paul Simon talking about God and his beliefs and spirituality. And I really enjoyed that clip.
Yeah, we'll actually play the clip as we end the podcast today. And if you're curious, skip ahead to the end. You can hear it at the end of this podcast. But we try to do a mix over on the premium Instagram account over the weekend, answer a lot of your questions, make it much more interactive than the regular Instagram feed. So make sure to join. Make sure to check that out over at mo.news/premium. It's a way to get access to that, but also support what we're doing here at Mo News.
And if all else fails, hopefully we win the lotto, right, Mosh? The Powerball and Mega Millions Powerball jackpots are now at a combined $1.9 billion. The lottery prizes swelled after no tickets matched all six numbers in drawings on Friday and Saturday night. So here we go again.
Yeah, we're talking about gratitude for the Almighty and the universe and also here on Earth. Lottery prizes are getting to record numbers. So Powerball is tonight. It is now up to $800 million. Mega Millions is tomorrow night at $1.1 billion. So just an update on that front.
Okay, let's get to some headlines here. The latest on the investigation into the deadly terror attack in Moscow as ISIS takes responsibility, but Putin tries to point the finger at Ukraine. The latest on Princess Kate after she went public with a cancer diagnosis Friday. Speaker Mike Johnson, we hardly knew you. We'll give you an update from Capitol Hill where we could see the third Speaker of the House in 6 months. Some Republicans are looking to oust Speaker Johnson. To the campaign trail where Democrats are trying to put legal obstacles in the way of independent RFK Jr.'s campaign. A new documentary on the dark side of Nickelodeon and a number of kids shows that millennials and Gen Z would be familiar with getting a ton of attention. We'll tell you about it. A former Supreme Court justice calls for term limits for the lifelong appointees. And we'll tell you about Ozempic babies. Yes, apparently Ozempic is actually linked to higher fertility. And last but not least, on this day in history.
Jill, it turns out March 25th gave us a lot of famous people. Happy birthday today to Sarah Jessica Parker, Elton John, Gloria Steinem, all that and more in today's On This Day in History.
Okay, the death toll has climbed above 130 from Friday's terrorist attack on a concert venue in suburban Moscow. Russia observed a national day of mourning yesterday for the victims of the attack. Most of those identified so far appeared to be in their 40s. Many had traveled from other parts of the country to attend the concert where a Russian rock band called Picnic was slated to perform on Friday night. Gunmen entered the concert venue Friday evening with automatic weapons, and then using explosives and flammable liquids, they set the building on fire, causing chaos as people began to run. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. American officials have attributed it to ISIS-K, which is a branch of the group. Russian authorities have detained at least 11 people, including four that they say were directly involved. Those four were charged in a Moscow courtroom on Sunday. They were blindfolded while in court and charged with terrorism. One of them is reportedly a citizen of Tajikistan. Though Russian officials and state media have largely ignored ISIS's claim of responsibility, and instead they are trying to suggest that Ukraine was behind the violence, Ukraine has denied any involvement. American officials say there is no evidence connecting Ukraine to the attack. On Saturday, Putin appeared to lay groundwork to blame Ukraine, claiming that the Ukrainian side had, quote, prepared a window for the attackers to cross the border from Russia into Ukraine.
Though we should note, he didn't mention any evidence of that as part of that quick address to the nation Saturday.
We are learning that the U.S. shared information with Russia in early March about a planned terrorist attack in Moscow and issued a public warning to Americans that are in Russia. Though it is unclear how many details they shared or whether Russia listened, the attack is a major embarrassment for Putin. It happened just 6 days after he cemented his grip on the country for another 6 years in last week's election.
Yeah, as far as that warning from the U.S., it's not clear whether the U.S. just said, hey, we're hearing intel that an attack might happen at some point somewhere, or there was more specificity there. For those wondering, the U.S. does have a policy of warning pretty much everyone in the world if there's a potential terror attack. While Putin is an adversary, the U.S. has no issue with the Russian people. So it made a point of warning the Russians and giving them the intelligence that we did have as far as a potential terror attack happening in Moscow or in Russia writ large. Again, no details there. Something actually similar happened in Iran in January. You might recall that ISIS attack in Iran, the U.S. issuing a warning just before that to the Iranian government saying, hey, we're picking up some intel that there might be some sort of terror attack coming soon. Again, unclear in that case how specific it was and whether Iran listened. As for ISIS here, many of you wondering why ISIS is attacking Russia. So they claim responsibility for the attack here. Their Afghan affiliate, which is called ISIS Khorasan or ISIS-K, came into existence about 10 years ago, back in 2014, 2015-ish in Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan. They are an offshoot of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Their leaders broke away, believing that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are not radical enough, not militant enough in their interpretation of Islam. So ISIS-K is like, no, we're the most hardcore, the most extreme out of anybody. And they basically have an issue with everybody. The U.S., the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, all Arab countries, pretty much all of Europe and Russia. You might have heard ISIS-K back in August of 2021 during the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. They were the ones who conducted that terror attack at the airport that killed a number of U.S. Marines and service members, as well as 150 Afghan civilians, as that withdrawal was happening back in August of 21. Now, as far as their issue with Russia here, they have a couple. One, Russia has been allied with the Syrian dictator Bashar Assad, who's been fighting ISIS. Also, the Taliban in recent months has gotten closer to the Russian government. And remember, ISIS-K hates the Taliban, and ISIS-K wants the Islamic State back, the one that existed a decade ago across Iraq and Syria that has been effectively decimated here. So a couple of reasons to go after the Russians here. It's not their first strike. They conducted an attack on Russian civilians in the Sinai Peninsula several years ago, as well as other attacks across Russia. And it's notable, Jill, that you mentioned one of the attackers is from Tajikistan. Tajikistan is a majority Muslim country that borders Afghanistan to the north there. Actually was a former member of the Soviet Union back in the day. And actually Tajikistan, modern day Tajikistan, was the area by which the Soviet Union, the Russians at the time, entered into Afghanistan and withdrew from Afghanistan from their 10-year war and occupation there. So it is notable that despite ISIS just coming out and saying, no, it was us and we're going to do more of this, Putin is really trying to make this about Ukraine and saying this was totally the Ukrainians' fault. The question is, how will he use that and what does it mean to the ongoing war there? There was a report over the weekend that the Russians are going to build up an extra force of 100,000 soldiers to conduct a new offensive inside Ukraine this summer.
All right, switching gears, Kate, the Princess of Wales, announced on Friday that she was diagnosed with cancer and is undergoing chemotherapy, breaking her silence after weeks of widespread speculation over her health. Kate is 42 years old and married to Prince William, Britain's future king. She was hospitalized for almost 2 weeks back in January after having major abdominal surgery. It was thought that her condition was non-cancerous and that the surgery had been successful, according to Kate's message on Friday. However, she said that tests after the operation found that cancer had been present. She said she was now undergoing a course of preventative chemotherapy on the advice of her medical team. She didn't specify what type of cancer she has or what stage it was found. And Kensington Palace, the couple's royal household, has not said why the operation was necessary. It led to months, again, of speculation we told you about. Here is a bit of the video that she released on Friday.
This, of course, came as a huge shock. And William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family. As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte, and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay.
She thanked the public for their support, but also asked for time, space, and privacy while completing her treatment.
Yeah, it's a second cancer diagnosis in just a matter of months here for the royal family. King Charles was diagnosed with cancer last month. He has also been undergoing treatment. Buckingham Palace has also not specified the type of cancer he has or what stage it was found at. But it was notable because there has been this feeling that there's been slightly more transparency from the king here than from Princess Kate. And that has really fed the speculation here in recent months. You could even call it a media frenzy, a social media frenzy, as the royal family tries to balance its desire for privacy with transparency and accountability in the modern media environment. So they had put out this initial statement in January, again saying it was non-cancerous, and she had had the surgery. And there are some people who are wondering about it. What really sent everything into overdrive was what we told you about recently, which was that Mother's Day photo she released that had been so digitally altered that a photo agency has actually took it down from the wire. So that didn't help them. That really fed the rumor mill here and led to, effectively, you couldn't go on social media, Jill, without seeing some sort of speculation. Late night TV, I think Colbert was speculating on an affair there. I imagine he's going to have to apologize for that tonight. But everyone from Blake Lively to Kim Kardashian and a whole bunch of gossip accounts were speculating a whole variety of things about her health, about alleged affairs, a whole variety of things. Jill, there was an Instagram account called Papologist that launched a 34-part series called Where the F is Kate Middleton. Incidentally, on Friday, minutes after the video came out, they took down the entire series and put up a note wishing good health for Kate. No real apology there. They did get a lot of followers out of it. So there were a lot of questions asked, and then there was some inappropriate stuff. And then there was stuff that really crossed the line here. Blake Lively has apologized for her post. And there was a lot of pushback over the weekend that Kim Kardashian should also apologize for her post where she said she's going to look for Kate Middleton. Again, posted before the cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, Moshe, I don't think anyone looks great coming out of this. I did want to mention, though, I think there have been a few questions about what exactly is preventative chemotherapy. According to The Guardian, it is a course of anti-cancer drugs given to mop up any cancer cells that might remain in the body after primary cancer treatment, which is usually surgical removal of a tumor. So the goal is to reduce the risk of the original cancer coming back and spreading. And this can happen when cancer cells, which are too small to detect with hospital scans and tests, are left behind after surgery. So I had received a couple of questions about that, and I thought that was a pretty good explanation.
Yeah, we're wishing her a quick recovery here. Again, we don't know much in the way of stage of cancer, type of cancer, et cetera. But that's what we know. And, hoping for a speedy recovery for Kate and her father-in-law, the king. All right, we have a lot more to get to in today's podcast. But first, we want to thank one of our newest partners here on the Mo News podcast, Good Chop. That is Good Chop, C-H-O-P. They offer customizable boxes of high-quality meat and seafood delivered directly to your door on your schedule. There's a lot more of this lately, Jill, especially those people looking for high-quality meat, high-quality fish. And we're loving Good Chop so far. The products are vacuum sealed. They are frozen at peak freshness, so you can stock your freezer and cook when you want it. And it includes everything from 100% grass-fed ribeyes, USDA prime filet mignon, sustainable and wild-caught seafood like salmon, cod, scallops, and shrimp. We have made the chicken, we have made the salmon, have loved it so far. And unlike many other companies, Good Chop sources its meat exclusively from American farms and fisheries, so you can support local farms and fisheries here in the U.S. They also make a point of sourcing meat that comes with no antibiotics, no added hormones, no artificial ingredients, only the good stuff. And when you calculate it out, the price per meal for Good Chop is just $3.74. So definitely check it out. You can go to goodchop.com/monews120. That is good, G-O-O-D, chop, C-H-O-P. .com/monews120 and use the code monews120 to get $120 off your first four boxes. Again, the code is monews120 at goodchop.com/monews120 for $120 off.
And Moshe, we are always talking about health trends and food trends here on the podcast and how hard it is to get all of your nutrients. Well, one way to get all of the important ones is Athletic Greens AG1 powder. I take AG1 in the mornings. It is just one scoop with a glass of water. It is easy and quick, and it lets you get on with your day knowing that you have gotten over 75 important ingredients, including tons of vitamins and minerals. It also has pre and probiotics to support digestion and gut health. I have a friend who calls it his insurance policy. He drinks it in the morning and feels like he's good for the rest of the day, regardless of what he eats or drinks. With your first purchase of AG1, Athletic Greens is giving Mo News listeners a free one-year supply of their vitamin D and five free travel packs of AG1. Visit drinkag1.com/monews to take advantage of this offer. You could get a discounted monthly subscription or try it one time for just a month. Again, drinkag1.com/monews, M-O-N-E-W-S, for this special deal, and really start to take ownership of your health. Time now for the speed read from ABC News. The good news for Congress and Speaker Mike Johnson this weekend, they avoided a partial government shutdown at the last second. The bad news for Johnson, there are now some right-wing Republicans calling for his head after he compromised with Democrats to get a major government budget bill passed. Far-right Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene on Friday was so upset that she filed a motion to oust Speaker Johnson, who is only 5 months into his tenure. You might remember he took over for former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who was ousted from the top job by a small group of the right-wing Republicans as well. Now, as far as timing, she just filed the motion to a committee, and it was not immediately clear how the House would act on her motion, which requires just a simple majority to remove the Speaker. Green told reporters that her motion to vacate was more of a warning than a pink slip, saying that she does not want to, quote, throw the House into chaos like the 3.5 weeks that the chamber was without a speaker when they did that with McCarthy.
Yeah, she got a lot of pushback over the weekend from fellow Republicans who are like, we cannot do this again. Please, you're not going to get a more conservative, more MAGA, pro-Trump speaker than Speaker Johnson, Congresswoman Green, which is probably the reason that she filed this motion to vacate, not as privileged, but to committee. Let me translate that. Basically, if she filed it as something called privilege, it would have gone straight to the floor for a vote. And that would have forced a vote within 48 hours. So we would have had one this weekend. But she's thrown it to a committee. The House is left for a two-week recess, what they call vacations there at the House. They're going to return April 9th. And so it's unclear if it'll ever see the light of day here, but she still wanted to make a point here. And she says the clock has started. It's time for a new speaker. Even Congressman Matt Gaetz, who, by the way, was the one who forced the vote to kick out McCarthy, told reporters he doesn't support doing this again 5 months later. Their concern is that the majority is now so thin after a number of Republicans have left the House with like a two-seat majority, they could actually see a Democratic speaker if they actually try to pull this again, given how narrow the margin is. So Gaetz did it for the first time in American history, the first time it was successful. Now we're here 5 months later. Again, a lot of Republicans saying, Congresswoman Green, please don't do this. Clearly, she's doing this partially for fundraising and publicity. She sent out multiple emails over the weekend asking people to give her money and mentioning that she was doing this. But a lot of Republicans, even very conservative ones, who are saying, listen, the president is a Democrat. The Senate is a Democrat majority. We do need to make compromises. We're not going to get perfect because we don't control everything. And that's a message that there are a handful of Republicans in the House that they don't want to hear it. They're like, no, we will get perfect or we will shut down the government. And so here you saw Johnson, who effectively, you know, went to Schumer and Schumer said, you don't have the votes, so you're going to have to vote on my plan and you're going to probably have to compromise with Democrats here, which is what Johnson did. But there's a handful of Republicans who don't like that. And so, you know, Marjorie Greene, you know, we'll see what comes of this, files this motion. At the same time, there are Republicans who say, why can't we be more like Democrats? And by that, they mean, you know, Democrats have a wide pendulum of thought, right? There's moderate Democrats, and then there's AOC and the squad. But when push comes to shove on major votes, they typically vote united, even if a certain part of the caucus is unhappy about something, because they realize that being in power and showing they can accomplish things and compromise is essential to the process, even if it frustrates them. And so that's why, even with a narrow majority, Nancy Pelosi was able to manage the AOCs, the Rashida Tlaibs, the Ilhan Omars of the world. And Republicans are saying, can we be more like that? You know, and they're saying that to the handful on the right. Guys, we're not going to get everything we want. We have to compromise. So this is something we're going to monitor. This is something that we knew was inevitable here. And we'll see what comes of it. Though, notably, Jill, some Democrats have been asked about whether, like the time McCarthy was ousted, whether they would vote to oust Johnson. Remember that the vast majority of the votes, once the Republicans called for it, came from the Democratic side to oust McCarthy. Some Democrats here saying, you know what, we don't think we should do this. We will support Johnson this time. So it does look less likely this time that you would see an ouster, at least as we speak here in late March.
Yes, the newest member of Congress, Tom Suozzi, a Democrat from the 3rd District here on Long Island, he came out to say that he would not vote to oust Johnson. And Moshe, you mentioned that the Republican majority in the House continues to get smaller. Well, on Friday, we got word that Representative Mike Gallagher, a Republican from Wisconsin, he's also the chair of the China Select Committee. Yeah. He said that he's going to be resigning on April 19th. He wasn't planning to run again, but he was originally going to at least wait until the end of the congressional session next January. But he also is just apparently done. They're just out.
There's a bunch of members who are like, I don't even want to stick around. I don't want to stay till the end of the year. Like, I'm so done with this place. Fun fact, Jill, some people from American history class might remember that Harry Truman referred to the Do Nothing Congress when he was frustrated with Congress for not passing certain bills. The Do Nothing Congress passed more than 700 bills in those 2 years. Jill, last year, the Congress passed 27, to give you a sense of where Do Nothing has gotten.
Okay, I don't want to get on a soapbox here, but I kind of feel like if you run for Congress, you know the drill, you know it's not a functional place. It's not like it was working really smoothly for the past decade. And I mean, things are worse, but they're not that much worse. So all of these people who say they're just going to
ditch early.
Yeah, who they say they're just not going to finish out their term. I mean, it costs a lot of money to run another special election. You've got candidates. Like, what is the deal? You made a commitment, finish it and be done, and then don't run again. How do you like that? I mean, I find it to be crazy. I've never heard of anything like it. I mean, it's essentially a contract that you make with voters.
Yeah.
Unless there's a very real issue that you can't finish out your term, like if you're sick or have a serious family emergency, I don't really understand why everyone thinks it's okay all of a sudden to just skip out. Moshe, I'm done. I'm going to leave the podcast. You got the rest of this, right? I'm just not in the mood.
I'm done. You can finish out this speed read. I got you.
Okay, staying with politics, this from Politico. Independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. polling as high as 20% in a three-way race with President Biden and Donald Trump. But getting on the ballot in all 50 states remains a major issue for him. It is an effort that requires gathering hundreds of thousands of signatures across the country, following different rules in every state, and may cost upwards of $15 million. Kennedy will also have to contend with determined opposition from the Democratic Party and outside groups that are trying to thwart his efforts out of fear that he could play spoiler and swing the election to Trump. Notably, RFK is taking more voters from Biden than Trump, at least according to recent polls. His campaign is officially on the ballot in one state, Utah, but it says it's collected enough signatures to also qualify in Nevada, Hawaii, and New Hampshire. American Values 2024, a pro-Kennedy super PAC, says it's collected enough signatures to get him on the ballot in Michigan, South Carolina, Arizona, and Georgia. So that adds up to 8 states at the moment, with a number of deadlines coming up soon.
Yeah, so 8 out of 50 there, though a couple of key states. If things hold up, New Hampshire, Nevada, Michigan, Arizona, and Georgia, 5 of those states are key swing states there. You know, remember in Georgia, it was less than 12,000 votes. That was the difference between Trump and Biden in 2020. At the same time, though, there is a big difference between meeting signature requirements and actually getting the candidate on the ballot. Every state has tricky different ballot access laws that can lead to prolonged court fights and keep a candidate off the ticket. Literally, they'll analyze every single signature. And in the past week, the Democratic Party and outside groups have put together a team to oppose third-party and independent candidates. It's a sign that Democrats are ready to fight back against candidates they perceive as spoilers here, Kennedy being one of them, and they will go after him in every single state. Remember, one of the reasons they believe Hillary Clinton lost by such a narrow margin in 2016 was because of third-party candidates like Jill Stein at the time in states like Wisconsin, etc., taking just enough votes. So in this case, they're seeing a very close election, and they're going to fight to keep Kennedy off the ballot. They see him as what they call a stalking horse to increase Trump's chance of winning. They make mention of the fact that some of the biggest contributors to Kennedy include Trump donors, including Trump mega donor Timothy Mellon, who has been donating to the Super PAC and is a big Trump supporter, but also donating to RFK Jr. So they're going to put up a fight here. They've put some real longtime pros in a group there to fight the Cornel West, the Jill Steins, the Robert F. Kennedys of the world, because Democrats are very concerned that this will be a repeat of 2016 and not 2020, because in 2020, everyone was sort of united try to take on Trump. And that's why they believe made the difference for Biden in that close election in 2020. Whereas in 2016, enough votes in a couple of key states went to the third party candidates. But I will note it is notable, Jill, because they're also talking about the importance of democracy here. And so critics of all of this, including the Kennedy camp, will say, you're talking about preserving democracy. And at the same time, you're trying to kick people off of the ballot. So what sort of democracy do you believe in, Democrats? So this is going to be one of the other storylines we're watching around RFK's candidacy in the coming months.
From the Washington Post, a new docuseries about a very dark side of Nickelodeon many of us grew up with is getting a ton of reaction. Moshe, I know you binged this over the weekend. The four-part series is called Quiet on Set, and it reveals a culture of abuse and a cycle of silence throughout the last 30 years. As the children's TV channel Nickelodeon was at the height of its popularity, the documentary is now streaming on Max, and it chronicles misogyny, racism, sexual and psychological abuse that some child stars experienced in the 1990s and early 2000s. It features interviews from former cast and crew members, and they talk about a volatile, dysfunctional, and sometimes sexualized environment. The series takes you behind the scenes of shows like All That and The Amanda Bynes Show, and it speaks to dozens of former stars and staff. Jamie Lynn Spears, Amanda Bynes, Ariana Grande, and Drake Bell were among the kid stars whose stories are told. Their careers were launched through shows on the network. Drake Bell's story is a focus of the series. He reveals that he was the anonymous survivor of a former Nickelodeon child coach named Brian Peck. Bell says that he was raped and assaulted multiple times by Peck. Peck was arrested back in 2003 and pleaded no contest, but would only spend 16 months in prison. The show reveals that he was then subsequently hired by the Disney Channel before they saw negative press coverage and fired him.
Yeah, really remarkable details in this, Jill, including that Disney Channel anecdote. That's, you know, somebody who did that to a child, got out of prison after just over a year and somehow found a job in children's TV again, albeit briefly. Drake Bell really plays central in this series. And the big revelation was he was effectively anonymous until now, but decided to go public for the purposes of this series to talk about his experience, his trauma, the assault. And Drake Bell is responding to Nickelodeon's statement that they're looking into this, they're investigating this, they're taking this very seriously. Now they're saying this in 2024. He finds it, quote, pretty empty from them, because a lot of these Nickelodeon shows are still streamed on the various apps, are still pretty popular. Drake saying that he has to pay for his own therapy. And they really haven't done much to care for any of the child actors in the aftermath of these revelations. And ultimately, you know, they say there was a culture that existed here that Nickelodeon was very aware of. Much of the focus of the show also lies on former Nickelodeon showrunner and producer Dan Schneider. He was the person behind hits like The Amanda Bynes Show, Victorious, Drake and Josh, and iCarly. And a number of stars accuse him of inappropriate behavior, asking women on the crew to give him massages on a daily basis, getting in young actors' personal space, recording their reactions, and just creating an environment of fear and possible retaliation for these kids that were acting, many in this case, for the first time. Schneider is responding, saying that, you know, watching the series has been embarrassing. He owes people an apology, but he's also very defensive of his actions and say that everything was approved by Nickelodeon. Jill, they focus in on this, but it's something that, you know, we've seen this storyline for a long time on how child stars are mistreated, not taken care of. And we've seen the effects of that, right? You can go back to Michael Jackson as a child star, the Olsen twins, Macaulay Culkin. We've seen these storylines over time, but it was pretty remarkable to see this series over the weekend. I highly recommend it. And we're actually trying to get one of the reporters who really dug into this, investigated this for Business Insider onto the podcast this week.
From NBC News, former Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer signaled support for term limits on the high court, provided that the terms are lengthy. So he was asked about this on NBC's Meet the Press Sunday. He said about age limits, I don't think that's harmful. Breyer is 85 years old. He said about those limits, quote, they'd have to be long. Why long? Because I don't think you want someone who is appointed to the Supreme Court to be thinking about his next job. He suggested that if there had been term limits, it could have helped him avoid going through difficult decisions about timing for his own retirement. After President Biden took office in 2021, Breyer became subject to a pressure campaign from progressives who wanted him to step down so that Democrats could ensure liberals have three seats. Democrats were haunted by the death of former Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at 87 years old in 2020, which paved the way for Justice Amy Coney Barrett's ascension to the high court. giving conservatives a sixth seat.
Yeah, there was a lot of pressure there, especially as liberals were already down to a 6-3 minority there on Breyer, who ultimately retires at age 84 there in 2022. There's actually a similar situation that is bubbling up right now in regards to Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who happens to only be 69 years old, but she reportedly travels with a medic and has some health issues here. So there are some progressive voices who are urging her to step down this year while Democrats still have the White House and still have a majority in the Senate. It's unclear whether she'll be responsive to that in any way. You haven't really seen the groundswell that you saw similar to Ginsburg or Breyer. Breyer, by the way, is doing a whole bunch of interviews. He actually also spoke with CBS News, where he discussed that controversial Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade. And he indicates in that interview that he would have considered joining Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, in a decision that would actually have banned abortion at 15 weeks to avoid completely overturning Roe v. Wade. Just a recap here. The case, the Dobbs case, was actually in regards to the Mississippi law at the time, which banned abortion at 15 weeks. Justice Roberts was trying to find a middle ground between the left and the right and say, maybe we just ban abortion at 15 weeks, but we preserve Roe v. Wade, the right to an abortion. But by then, there were five other conservatives on the court with the new Amy Coney Barrett addition to the court. So ultimately, his compromise didn't really go anywhere. But it was interesting to hear Breyer in these interviews talk about, you know, could they have found a middle ground there? And, you know, a liberal justice saying, yeah, maybe I would have banned abortion in 15 weeks to be able to preserve Roe here. So always interesting to hear justices. It's so rare to hear them after they're on the court where they feel this opportunity to be completely candid. Jill, we should note that among developed democracies, advanced democracies in the world, we're the only country that has no term limits for our highest court in the land. Many countries, in some cases, it's 10 years, some it's 15 years, some it's 7 years. And so that's something that has certainly been discussed that would require a constitutional amendment. But there's been a lot of scrutiny for the court in the last couple of years. And you've seen the numbers when it comes to trust, that people are trusting it less. So that is one suggestion that is thrown out there to try to boost trust in the court again.
And from USA Today, a look at what's being called Ozempic babies. Women are getting pregnant, in most cases unintentionally, they say, while taking weight loss medications like Ozempic and Mounjaro, despite being on birth control or dealing with years of fertility issues. Facebook groups, Reddit threads, and TikTok videos are connecting women who are pregnant with or already had an Ozempic baby or Mounjaro baby, as they've come to be called, and want to share their surprise pregnancy experiences. Reproductive and obesity medicine experts tell USA Today that they're also noticing the trend in their offices, which they say is likely happening for two reasons. First, weight loss is correcting hormonal imbalances that are caused by obesity and metabolic disorders, and thus boosting fertility. Second, certain drugs could be reducing the efficacy of birth control pills, increasing the chances of pregnancy. Yet, under no circumstances should women use weight loss drugs to get pregnant, according to experts. Studies on rats, rabbits, and monkeys showed that these medications, if taken while pregnant, can actually lead to miscarriage and birth defects. No studies, by the way, have been done on humans. Drug manufacturers recommend that women stop taking weight loss drugs at least 2 months before a planned pregnancy.
Yeah, we should note that in many cases, when they talk about taking certain drugs and leading to birth defects, they typically test that on animals. They wouldn't want to risk giving that to humans and risking those birth defects on humans. Jill, this story got a lot of attention online over the weekend. And we got a couple notes from people in the Mo News community saying, I have an Ozempic baby coming, or I know of somebody with an Ozempic baby coming. There has been research for decades now that has established a strong connection between obesity and metabolic disorders like PCOS and fertility issues. So it isn't too surprising to see that weight loss medication are helping women with these conditions get pregnant. Scientifically, the way they explain it is fat cells release estrogen. So the more a person gains weight, the more estrogen they will have. Excess estrogen can prevent regular menstruation or of ovulation, which then can make it hard to get pregnant. Obesity also causes insulin resistance, which can lead to high levels of male sex hormones like testosterone, which also don't support pregnancy. So basically, if you're overweight or obese, it becomes more difficult to get pregnant. So the more weight you lose, the more that could open things up. Though they do note in this study that these drugs affect each person's body differently. And again, they warn, like, don't start taking Ozempic if you want to get pregnant. They don't want to connect those two. And at the end of the day, one doctor quoted here says that while the story is out there and we just told you about it, if you're using birth control and you're on medications like Ozempic, the risk of unintended pregnancy is still quite low. So of course, there are, given how many people are on them now, there are these storylines coming out, but doctors warn that they are rare. All right, that brings us to On This Day in History. Jill, we're going to go way back. Take the Wayback Machine 700 plus years to Scotland in 1306.
The Wayback Machine.
The Wayback Machine. The Wayback Machine. And if you're a Braveheart fan, you're familiar with this story. But on this day in 1306, Robert the Bruce was crowned the King of Scotland. He would go on to free Scotland from English rule. He fought alongside William Wallace, who, of course, is depicted by Mel Gibson in Braveheart, another figure in the Scottish history and push for independence. But anyway, I don't often take you back to the 14th century, but on this day, we will. Fast forward to the 20th century, a much more familiar century for this segment. On this day, the Reverend Martin Luther King led 25,000 people to the Alabama state capitol after a five-day march from Selma to protest the denial of voting rights for Black Americans. It came just a couple weeks after the tragic Bloody Sunday incident on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Finally, authorities would allow this march to move forward. Jill, I mentioned at the top, this day, March 25th, a number of celebrities born on this day. Happy birthday to Sarah Jessica Parker, Elton John, and Gloria Steinem, who turns 90 years old today. We should also note Aretha Franklin, who we lost just a couple years ago, also born on this day. And a couple songs and TV shows we want to mention before we go here. On this day, 64 years ago, Ray Charles recorded Georgia on My Mind. Keep Georgia on my mind. And 22 years ago today, Sheryl Crow released Soak Up the Sun. And Jill, in TV history on this day, one of my favorite shows from the 80s, Perfect Strangers, premiered on ABC 38 years ago today with Bronson Pinchot and Mark Lynn Baker.
Balky.
Hey, cousin.
I love that show.
People of a certain generation will get the reference. And we end here with The Bachelor, which turns 22 years old today. Jill, on this day in history, The Bachelor premiered for the first time on ABC. Alex Michelle was the Bachelor on that episode. It was so successful that they would then premiere the following season, The Bachelorette. And now, two decades later, I feel like we're on, you know, the 100 umpteenth version of Bachelorette and Bachelor at this point.
Well, we're now at the Golden Bachelor.
Yes. Well, actually, I was looking it up. Alex Michelle, who happened to be a 31-year-old bachelor 22 years ago, would be 53 years old today, just to give you a sense of how old the first batch. The first Bachelor and Bachelorette contestants are will soon be grandparents.
All right, Mosh, let's wrap up the podcast on this Monday. Thank you for listening to the Mo News podcast. If you like what you hear, please share this with your friends. It will help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and review us in the App Store. And Mosh, I hope I didn't get too fired up about the members of Congress who were leaving before their terms are up.
Just note, Jill, we're going to vote for you for Congress because we know that regardless of whether you like it there, you will stick it out through your entire term. Jill, at some point, we do need to get to the storyline that your former Congressman George Santos is running in a neighboring district.
Oh, my God. Yes, as an independent.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, he's not going to make it. But anyway, still interesting storyline. We will tell you more about it.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding me.
In a coming edition. Well, he won't be your Congressman again. It'll be your neighbors. And as we noted at the top, we're going to play a clip here of Stephen Colbert and Paul Simon talking about gratitude, God, and the universe. Profound thoughts, interesting thoughts to send you on your way this Monday.
You know, it sounds like song. It is a song, but it's a song to God. Yeah. Are you yourself a man of faith?
I would say yes. Well, let me put it another way. I think we're in an unbelievable paradise on earth, and life is so mysterious, a mystery. Like in the rest of our galaxy, there's really no other life. And we don't know what's going on. So life is incredible. So I think, what a great job you did, your God, with this planet. Excellent. I'm in. And the universe, Paul Simon, hats off to you, God. Fantastic universe.
So your faith is an act of gratitude.
In an act of gratitude. But then I think, if the explanation for our creation is not there was a creator, but there's another explanation, I think I'm no less grateful and I'm no less in awe of everything, and it's not going to change my morality. I'm not going to think bad is good now and good is bad, because I feel when it's good and I feel when I do bad. So in the two choices between is there a creator or is there another explanation, I like the creator story. That's where I'm at with that. You?
What?
You?
I was sort of convicted of my atheism for many years, and then I was overwhelmed by an enormous sense of gratitude for the world. And that resonates for me, because this enormous heartbreaking gratitude, even for heartbreaking things, not because the world is beautiful, but the beauty isn't necessarily happy things. The joy is greater than happiness, and happiness is not the ultimate goal. Sublime is the goal. And so that feeling that even comes in grief, grief with you is an act of love. And so we can both be sad, and yet there is joy there because of our ability to share our love in that moment and heal and care for each other. That feeling that even in that there could be something beautiful led me to an enormous, overwhelming, uncontainable sense of gratitude.
I understand.
And it had to go someplace.
Absolutely.
And that led me back to my relationship with what I now call my God.
Yeah, I understand completely. Yeah.